grill, like the truth, like the capital T truth. Because it allows for us to rationalize our thoughts, whereas we think as like emotions as being something that is irrational, or something, our subjectivity is something that needs to be controlled because it's multiple and it's pluralistic, like people are going with their ideas here and there, whereas science is very like, okay, this is the experiment that we're going to do, these are the research goals, and this is going to be the outcome.
And it's replicatable.
Yes, yes, when it is not. Because the context of, for example, let's take like women's health, for example. Like I'm collecting data. I'm a person who is collecting data about women's health in BC, if that's the project that I'm working on. And I want to see, okay, well, what are some of the issues that are common common to females here? And like female who like self-identify themselves as. So if I try and experiment people here, and I'm like, okay, these are the five factors these are the five things that come up the most common. And if I go and try and replicate it in Pakistan or India, those five things will not hold true, because what we consider even a disease or we consider a health problem is very subjective, in the sense that people who might be like... It's sort of like a privilege to health and medical resources might think about disease or problems in a certain way, whereas people in India or Pakistan, where sometimes it is a problem of having food on the table, so they might think of problems and issues and health in a different parameters. So even defining health, for example, is impossible to have it like a universal definition of health. And so thinking about science, like science coming in, I'm not saying we should not believe in science. I know a lot of people are like, oh, we will not be like believers in science. I don't think I'm coming from that place. I'm coming from a place of where it becomes like a top-down approach, where it is being messaged from the top to the people, to the general people, about what science is or what health should be, or these are the issues that you should be thinking about, not these. Like leaving out the embodiment portion of it also is important. And so like science for too long has been associated with ideas of neutrality, when a lot of the history of science, so I recommend looking into Bruno Latour, who actually calls himself a sociologist, but he questions how we do science and how we think about experiments. So I recommend reading his work. But essentially what he does is he goes into, he's now like dead, but so he's like a very old author. He went into look how like clinical psychological experiments were being held at the time, and like he has a whole book where he talks about how like experimentation and this idea of like objectivity in science came to being. So trying to figure out schizophrenia and trying to like box people into different categories of like mental health implications and so on. And so, like, he questions how we come up with those categories in the first place to think about, oh, but we're going to provide them this medication and this, this, and that. But, like, how do you even categorize people on the basis of, like, their mental health conditions? Because it is, like, there is no universal way to know that. And so, like, he starts to question, like, is even science or data, can it be neutral or not? And so thinking about objectivity not only as like a parameter, as the first parameter of judging if research is good or not, that has a fallacy for sure. And I think thinking about data as more like subjective and coming from the community and all these like feminist approaches to it allows us to question the pedestal which we put the data on. And also like data is not singular, because it cannot be singular, because it is being collected and distributed and consumed and used and like profited on through multiple literally multiple like ways. So one example that I often sort of think of is, like, do you know, like, on LinkedIn, there's always, like, these, like, ghost employers who, like, post, like, this is the opening in our, like, in our, within our workspace, you should apply. And then, and when you go and apply to such positions, you'll always see, like, 10,000 people have already applied to this position. And I had, like, one friend come up to me and be like, well, what is the point if, like, our job market is so bad, if there's, like, one, there's one entry-level job and 10,000 people are applying to it? And recently there has been a study that is done on, like, ghost employers and how, like, using those, like, LinkedIn and Indeed and all those, like, job platforms, posting platforms, people are actually, so the company folks are actually collecting data about people's resumes, about certain job profiles, and they're trying to automate hiring. They're trying to create hiring algorithms so they can replace, like, HR and stuff in their own, like, in their own respective companies. It is happening with some, like, shady companies. So what essentially happens is, if you apply to the position, they're gonna scan, and so there's, if there's 10,000 people applying, they have, like, a data of 10,000 resumes. So they're gonna pull, like, information, see, like, oh, okay, well, for this entry position, I see everybody at least here has a bachelor's and a master's. So, okay, if they have a bachelor's and master's and they did from this school in this area and they have this PIN code in their, like, and this phone number, like, this area code in the phone number. So the hiring system is created according to, like, all the information that they get. Okay, this is, so if this area, like, 778 is, like, for example, like, Vancouver's, like, phone area code, they have, like, a higher chance of getting hired. So they are creating, like, these differences within the hiring system to see, okay, well, if they are local, so they want somebody who is local, but also somebody who has been to, like, SFE or UBC. And so they're trying to, like, automate the hiring process. But what happens in that is, like, people who are going to community colleges or people who have, like, other kinds of experiences are being left out. And it is so bizarre to even think, if your application has, say, the word, I don't know, collaborated, you have a higher chance than a person who said, who did not use the word collaborated in their resume, just because it is automated. This is so insane, honestly.
I think this is a really good place to take a break and come back, because this idea of how data is being skewed in a way and revisioned into what it is and what it isn't really touches upon how it gets used or misused in migration and immigration policy. And so we're just going to hear a couple of short announcements, and then we're going to come back to this big topic.
Soca's first and second year social is happening soon. Join SFE Soca, the Students of Caribbean and African Ancestry, in the Student Union Building, room 1430, on Friday, October 4th, from 5 p.m. onwards. This event is for the first and second years to meet and connect with new friends. All are welcome. See you there.
Coco.
And I'm DJ Star.
Come join us for Slumber Party, Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
You'll hear female artists, oversharing, and research on health, psychology, and identity.
Hope to see you there.
And here we are back on Intravenous. I'm Robin.
I'm Rebecca.
And I'm Pranjali.
And we've been talking about data feminism and the ways and the principles by which we might see data used in different ways that create a little bit more equitability and fairness. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that the data is being used is in migration and with just border patrol in, mm-hmm. in general, right? And I found this article. It's a very short little article. It's not even an article per se. It's more of a resource page from National. Oh my goodness, they made their icon so small I can't even read it. Anyways, it says immigration is a feminist issue. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how this works here in Canada, but probably not a whole lot different than the United States, which is where this this figure comes from. But women and children comprise approximately 3/4 of people migrating to the U.S. And so just that, right? Just that makes it a feminist issue. 70% of immigrant women attain legal status through a family-based visa, mm-hmm. but the backlog is so severe that there are millions of people who are waiting to be reunited with their families. And the rubric of data mm-hmm. that's being used to associate how people's eligibility to come to the country and
yeah.
and how they get classified is all based on data,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Which, when women may have worked in the home or, you know, may have done work that doesn't categorically check off a box that we would categorically have the same checkbox in Canada, and we would have to check other because that's our option, right? It skews the ways in which we get viewed at the border
mm-hmm.
for whatever that eligibility is. And
yeah.
And if there's any kind of questionability about your identity for whatever reason,
mm-hmm.
Then that becomes even more dubious,
yeah.
I guess, in terms of like, how does it get classified? Also, does it get classified in a way that I'm going to feel fairly represented?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it, you know, skewing the data in a way that is negatively affecting my application or what have you? And so, yeah.
Yeah, and also, like, I want to start talking about this by, like, professing that I'm not a legal scholar at all. So the things that I might say don't come from like a very like legal perspective, but it comes from a social and cultural perspective about these issues. So, and at some point I think I'll go back to school and maybe I'll do law, but then we'll see. First I want to actually talk about the idea of representation at the border and in the data that you mentioned, Robin, because just before the break we were talking about like how hiring systems like are being automated and then representation of the candidates in those hiring pools are being used or are being skewed in a way that benefits some over the other. And so this is kind of the case with a lot of like different industries. It's not just the HR, or it's just not just the hiring side of things. It is happening at the border. It is happening in in a lot of things, like our regular interactions with the colonial legacy structures in general. Unknowingly, we tend to participate in those systems sometimes. And this reminded me of actually a piece by Anne Hoffman, and they talk about this idea of data violence, in which they talk about the trans experiences at the airport, and how the profiling of the people at the airport, if your body or if your aura does not fit the binary at the airport or at the security line, you are treated very differentially, and what that means for you as a person who is experiencing it, but also what does it reflect about the social structures, which is so associated with the binaries, every single thing. And the project, actually, why I moved into looking at border and immigration services is because of my own experience throughout the summer term. And those experiences have been so eye-opening, because I was reading all these books at the time. I was doing literature review, which is something that you do when you write a thesis. You do literature review, and then you find an object of study, and then you do the actual research and all those things. And I was reading, and I was also presenting some of my work through conferences, research conferences at different universities, like ones in London and also in Amsterdam and in different places. And I was so I am actually not a Canadian passport holder. I am an international student here. And so this is a fact that I think I have been trying to distance myself from. I'm not an international student. I'm just everybody here. That is something that I think I was doing unknowingly for a long time. I came here in 2020. So I was I'm not everybody. And people used to comment and be well, your English has no accent. This is so good. This is great. And I was I don't know if it should be considered as a compliment or it should be considered as, taking a dig at people's command over the very colonial English language, and I was okay, well. And then I started to think about my interactions at the border and all those kinds of questions, because this was a common experience. So if you are a Canadian or a native passport holder, your lines are separate and faster and everything as compared to people who have non-native passports. So everybody else has to stand in a certain line, and people who have native passports, they are not being questioned by an actual border police officer, whereas people who are actually non-native passport holders, you are subjected to questioning and further you have to show them all the documents, do you have enough money to come into this country? There's so much stuff that you need to do, which is so interesting to me. Because here, when I was in Canada, I was on a student visa, so my conditions were different from being a visitor in a country, but with the same Indian passport. And I for the first time, I felt, okay, well, I'm actually being subjected to, all these questions and all these, why are you here? When are you going to go back? And I was well, okay, interesting. I did not face that here, because in a student visa, for the entirety of the term that you're here, you're sort of not questioned, because you're paying thousands of dollars to the university and stuff. So that is a different thing. I was wait, what? I am being subjected to all of these things. And I think I come from a place of privilege. I have a lot of privilege as compared to a lot of people. And this made me think about the piece that I was reading is Susan Laystar's piece. And she is amazing, amazing, amazing person. And she also comes from a background in sociology. I don't know if you've read any of her works, but there's a piece where they talk about, the piece's title is called To Classify is Human. To Classify is Human. And they talk about this idea of classification, differentiation, creating those different lines and creating those different systems. So for people who had NATO passports passports, they could, just go through the SWIFT line and they could just check in digitally and stuff. And whereas the people who had other passports were subjected to questioning, but also like all the wait times and delays and like all the confusion and mess of the airport that I'm sure people know about. And a lot of people there were also like refugees trying to come in the country for the first time. And so like there were like big families with so many like little kids and mothers.
And paperwork, just like, oh my, folders full of paperwork, right?
Yeah. Also, like, incidentally, I just reflected on the thing that I actually, when I first came here in Canada, like, the first sort of actual job that I did was at the airport. Like, I was working as a COVID-19, like the person who helps you with like data inputting for the COVID-19 things that you have to show when you like arrived, like 2020, like when you first arrived. Like I was that person, and that just made me think about like how we treated like foreign quote unquote passports. And there was a family I remember vividly, like the mother and the children did not have their passports because they were trying to run from the country that they were originating from, and only the male person, the one male person in the family, had their passport. And so there was a whole lot of confusion of how can we even let them in, like COVID aside, but also like traveling because their passport were confiscated because they are women, so they didn't have passports. And so, like, there was a lot going on at the moment. And I was thinking, well, okay, our interaction with borders not only happen in the airport and during the immigration lines, but also when we think about being on the app, on a social media app, like, we are being bounded by the platform. And the interaction that we have on those platforms are being, like, serving as, like, a boundary work. So, like, us being on those platforms and us like interacting and going into the real quote unquote like real world, like how does that shape or change? So thinking about those interactions, but also thinking about the interactions that people have on a daily basis with border control being nullified. For example, there's an author who also works in thinking about how like queer influencers are occasionally flagged on platforms like Instagram because their bodies are ambiguous, quote unquote, for the platform. And so those creators are being like banned, or like there's a term called shadow banning, wherein people of like influencers or people of color are like mysteriously banned from the platform for doing things that would be normal if they were not people of color. And so thinking about those like ideas of like, okay, what is legal and what is illegal, and all those questions about like being viewed within the parameters, not only on like social media, internet, like our health service that we feel, okay, well, this is who I am and this is my age and all those questions, but also at the border, like that is like the first thing that I should have been thinking about, and I feel so bad. So yeah, thank you so much for bringing that report up, because it is a feminist issue. It is not just because women and children are like overrepresented in the numbers of people who are trying to migrate and seek refuge, but also in the fact that there needs to be a lot of changes within how we view migration and immigration. And I know a lot of the like previous scholars have worked. So for example, like the immigration, I was looking at this case of there's a Maru incident which happened with like Sikh Indians trying to come into Canada in the 1914. And I just remember that their ship was returned back because they did not have like, so they were like traveling with ship at the time, and Canada was a British colony at the time. And India was also a British colony at the time. And so like, So the whole idea of like paperwork and documents and like hierarchies and all those categories is a colonial project, is what I'm trying to link it to. And so like trying to control borders as if they were like, I don't know what, as if they were like these governments or these profit-making people's things, is interesting to me. Honestly, I don't even know. But yeah, any thoughts, questions?
This is completely like new to me, topic wise.
So I'm just like trying to like soak it all in terms of how we're sort of seeing, I guess, sort of like a hint at what the future is going to look like in terms of the automated like decision making coming in and AI coming in, and how it's going to be a big sort of influence and role in so many areas, and we're only seeing it in like a couple at the moment, and that there's like so many kinks in it that I don't think get like spoken about from like what you're saying. Like, this is all completely new to me. I've not seen any of this like in the news. All I see in the news is AI is taking over the world and it's like this huge sensationalized headline.
So that frustrated,
there's going to be robots running everything, and you don't hear about like the stuff behind this and about how there was a quote from an article that I was reading when I was trying to figure out kind of what data feminism is in prep for today. And it was saying that the overarching goal of data feminism is to take a stand against the status quo, against a world that unfairly benefits the narrative that is overwhelmingly rich, white, cisgendered, heterosexual, non-disabled men.
Yeah.
And it's the fact that that isn't spoken about at all in the news in terms of data feminism or data.
Yeah.
And that there's a narrative that's supporting, as we spoke about last week, the white man's truth. And I'm just like, it's baffling
to
me.
It is. Yeah.
It's honestly baffling. Like, the more I find out about different concepts and like, because we touch upon, like, I guess, the main, like, quote, main ones in sociology of, like, your patriarchy and, like, the workplace and, like, the home life and things like that. But then you have all of these, like, little sub-areas that are all, like, coming up and you don't ever, like, hear about them in the news or anything.
Yeah, especially, like, the rhetoric with AI has been so interesting to me because, as I was, like, saying in the beginning a little bit, this has been a like repetitive cycle. Like, when the first like personal computers came, like, people were like, oh well, everything is going to be so like, you know, non-hierarchical because people will have access to personal computers, they can click and program whatever way they want. And then this idea of like ubiquitous computing, that if you touch one thing, everything is going to be so connected that everything just like turns into magic. And and then internet, and we're like, there's actually a manifesto like which says like how internet could have been so liberating and so like freedom and so egalitarian and so like so many different things. And the same thing or like in a different way is being talked about how like AIs or very automated and robotified world could look like. But there has been a lot of pushback on saying, oh well, it's going to take over jobs. Well, so a lot of my work actually previously was looking at like labor, workplace, and like automated systems in the Amazon warehouse. Yes, we have only 2 minutes. So the chapter 7, which actually talks about visibilizing the labor. So a lot of the like algorithms on which the automated systems are being trained on is something which actual people in Philippines, India, China are actually doing, Indonesia are doing, to actually allow the algorithm to learn from the training data, quote unquote, the data that we say that, oh, this is going to train on these commands and these examples. So that is how an AI machine or machine learning works, because we give them a data set and we give them a trained data set to tell, okay, if there's a tongue, flag it. And so like it automates over time, like it trains on the data, quote unquote. And so like how the training happens reveals is being so like is not being it's not being so like revealing. It has been invisibilized. The labor of the people who are actually doing this stuff has been invisibilized for so long. And then thinking about like robots and stuff. So the first ever robot that was like created in sci-fi films and stuff in the 50s and 60s was actually using a slave man. That was the first ever robot, because quote unquote robot, because it we can go and talk about it a lot. And Ruha Benjamin's book, actually, Race After Technology, I think she picks up the example there, or Safia Noble is the other author who do this kind of work. So we can talk about it some other time also.
Yeah.
I think we should all just take a big collective breath.
I'm sorry for throwing all this information.
It's a lot of information. It's data. So it makes sense. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned to Democracy Now!
Hi, I'm Amy.